Senior editor of the journal Organizational Science. He's a recipient of the David L. Bradford Outstanding Educator Award, a 3M Fellowship for Teaching Excellence, and the 1989 CASE Canadian Professor of the Year Award for Teaching. He received the Financial Post Leaders in Management Educational Award in 1997, and he was the first non-American winner of the prestigious Distinguished Educator Award from the Academy of Management in 1998. He is the author or editor of over 10 books, including Organizational Reality, Reports from the Firing Line, it's into its sixth edition now, HRM Reality, Putting Competence in Context, Reframing Organizational Culture, and the book that he's going to be discussing this evening, Toxic Emotions at Work. This will be published by Harvard Business School Press in January. It's already published. What am I talking about? You wrote this before it was published. That's cheating.
No, it's marketing.
It's marketing. Okay. This book follows on an article that was published in the January 2002 issue of the Harvard Business Review entitled Leading in Times of Trauma, and a couple of other articles that are also a part of the line of thinking that led to this book. One is Why Compassion Counts in the Harvard Business Review, in the Journal of Management Inquiry, and The Toxic Handler in the Harvard Business Review. Both of those appeared in 1999. Dr. Frost has agreed to sign copies of his book if you wish to receive that. If you've purchased a book of his, they're being sold out in the lobby right now, and they will be at the end of this lecture. If you wish to get him to sign it, he'll stay here for a little while after the question period, and we'll sign books. So, that's a long introduction, but that's your fault because you've done so much. Dr. Frost.
Thank you. Thank you, Pat. Thanks very much. Thank you. I'm really honored to have been asked to give the talk tonight. I'm stunned at how many of us want to spend a Saturday night talking about toxic emotions. Maybe that's something of the times. I'd like to go through some of the ideas that are in the book that have developed out and interlace some of the observations with some of the stories that I've used to kind of capture some of the aspects of the ideas. And then we'll go for a period of time and then see where we are, and I'm happy to take questions. The fundamental issue in this book, I think, is that the argument that there's inevitably pain in organizations. And I love this quote. I was watching the movie The Princess Bride with my family one night towards the end of writing the book. And one of the things that I was doing, and those of you who have written that way know that towards the end things come out that you hadn't thought of before, or you discover things that fit very nicely. And there's this line in the movie that Dread Pirate Robert says, "His life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling something." And I thought, that's exactly right. That's exactly what I needed for the last chapter, or near the last chapter, of talking about the book. So I wound the tape backwards and forwards until I got the lines right. And then I thought, I really ought to go and read the book. I read the book, and it's not in the book. It's only in the movie. But I'll take it wherever it goes. So what I want to talk about tonight are some themes that revolve at the base around the aspect that it's inevitable that there's pain in organizations. It comes from the effects of mergers, from change. It comes from incompetent bosses. It comes from an absence of certain humanity in the organization. It can also come from outside being brought in. And so I want to talk about the pain and then talk about how, while that pain is inevitable in organizations, sometimes it turns toxic. And by toxic, I mean that the pain, either the way it's delivered or the way it's received, and when people are in pain, the way they're handled, robs them of their hope, robs them of their self-esteem, robs them of their confidence. And under those circumstances, then people tend to disconnect from their energy and their focus and their best effort at work and obsess on the pain. So I want to talk a bit about what happens and what causes that in organizations. And then as I was working with this material at one point and thinking, yes, that's right, I asked myself the question, well, if that's true, how come we get so much work done anyway? If we're all disconnected, and I'm sure we feel that way from time to time, the fact of the matter is we get the job done most of the time. And there are a number of different reasons why that might be so, but the one that I settled on, and I'll talk a bit about that as well as how I came on the notion, is that I think that there are people in organizations, I focused on managers, it's not just managers, and there are people in families and there are people in relationships who handle the pain for others. They pick up the pain. And they do it for a variety of reasons, which we'll talk about. But when they do that, they help the connection back by taking the pain and doing something with it to help the person get back into focus. And I want to talk a bit about what that handling looks like and how that works in an organization. I think it can work in other situations as well. And then what I found as I started to do that, work with that idea, and talk about it with managers, the next thing that occurred to me was that the people who do that in organizations are not very well trained to do it. They're not specialists in pain management or pain handling. And so if they're not careful, they get very sick. The toxins leak into the people who are handling the pain. And so there's another piece that we want to go to. And then I have a whole section that I've developed in the book about healing the handlers and what they can do for themselves and what they need to do in the organization and what the organization needs to do to help the handlers do their job well and survive. And in the last part of the story that we'll talk about here is two observations. One is that leaders, by nature of their job, create pain. All leaders create pain, in my view, and that goes with the territory. If you're not doing the work of a leader, pushing change, managing change, getting people to do things differently, dealing with the uncertainties in the world in ways that may not please everybody, you're probably not doing a good job as a leader. But the really good leaders know that, and when they do that, and they know that the pain is being created, they either do some things to cushion the pain ahead of time, or they go back and mop up the pain. And my argument is that leaders, that needs to be more of what leaders do, because the people who are doing the handling at the moment have their fingers stuck in the dike, in the toxins in organizations, and I do believe there's a lot of toxins in organizations these days. And then the final part of it I want to talk about is, well, if leaders have a role, what role do organizations have to support the handler, to help the leadership, and to help the organization towards health rather than toxicity? So that's the sort of broad outline of what I'd like to talk about. And I'd like to start the conversation with two stories. One is one of my own, and the other one is going to be on a brief video clip, which we'll see in a moment. And the first story took place about 7 years ago in VGH. I was in a hospital ward with three other men. We'd all had surgery for cancer. Mine was melanoma cancer. I'd had some lymph nodes removed. But the story isn't really about me. It's about the man who was across from me in a bed. I was next to the window here. He was across from me, a man probably in his 70s, who'd had his esophagus and his stomach removed. And he had tubes and all sorts of things into his body. And on this particular morning that I observed this, what happened that day, if you've been in a hospital, if you've been a patient, you know that they wake you up early and they take your temperature and do the blood pressure and so on. So I was awake, nothing much to do except lie there. I wasn't completely incapacitated, but it was only a day or two after the surgery. And the man across from me, the man with the stomach removed and the esophagus removed, got up to try to go to the washroom. And he got halfway across and failed. Too many tubes, too much effort. He wasn't strong enough. And so he was completely devastated. It was very embarrassing. The nurse got him, put him back to bed, fixed things up, and went off shift. The next nurse was coming in. Well, he looked awful. He had this gray look. He didn't look, you know, he looked completely out of it, which one would anticipate if you were in that situation. And then I had a day to watch the new nurse come in and what she did. And she did a lot of the things that you would expect a nurse to do. They're in the job description. She took his temperature, blood pressure, got the mechanics in to look at the pipes. She got a dietitian in to look at what was happening there. She got the doctor in, of course. She got the family in. All the sorts of things you would see were technically competent for a nurse. But because I had nothing to do and the day to do it in, I watched what she was doing. And in addition to all of those things, she held his hand from time to time. She pulled the curtains around him. She gave him words of encouragement. She did a lot of little things that are quite subtle and not the things that you normally note. And at the end of her shift, he was sitting up in bed, his color was back, he was reading the paper. And this is about 5 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever it was. And so I got up out of bed and I went over to him and I said, you're a very brave man. It's good to see you looking better. And he said, you know, I didn't give a damn this morning when that happened to me. I didn't care anymore. It was so embarrassing. I was so defeated by it that, you know, what was the point? And he said, now I feel much better. And I don't know that he knew all the things that had contributed to that. When you're in the middle of a crisis like that, you don't notice. But he had recovered considerably. Now, I didn't look at that story and say, oh, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to have all this thing. And it was just one of those things that registered. I left the next day. I don't know what happened to him. I wrote a card to the hospital acknowledging that I thought the nurse had done a fine job. And when I've given this talk to audiences that have a number of healthcare workers and nurses and care workers in the audience, and there may be some here tonight, the usual feedback I get is, yes, that's right. Nobody sees that stuff, but it's done, and it often makes a difference. Now, she is she's the first of my handlers, if you like. She handled the pain, the discouragement, the lack of hope in this man's experience, and I think made a contribution to his turnaround for that day. Now, the second story I want to tell you and show you is a story from a movie called The Doctor with William Hurt. William Hurt is the doctor. You may or may not have seen the movie. It's a good movie, and I always justify showing these clips so that people go out and rent the movie, and then everybody does fine. But in this movie, William Hurt is a surgeon who's a brilliant surgeon, but a lousy interpersonal. He basically either ignores the people he's working on or disparages them. And there's a scene in the movie where he's walking down with residents and they're asking him, well, what do you think, Mr. whatever his name is, should a surgeon show care or should they be good at cutting? And he said, well, what do you want, somebody who cuts well or somebody who's just smiling and nice to you? And of course, it's a false dichotomy. But he has this dichotomy. His view is, I cut, I don't care what happens after, that's my job. And then he gets sick. He starts to cough and he coughs up blood. And as he's coughing up this blood and getting a little alarmed about it, he eventually goes to see a specialist for a diagnosis. And the clip I want you to see now is that encounter he has with a specialist. And if you feel like you need to cough or clear your throat at some point during here, that's fine. That tends to happen. So let's get this over to video. And hopefully we've got the sound right. And just have a look and watch what you're seeing compared with what I just said in terms of the other story, and let's see what we find.
Hello. Sorry to keep you waiting, busy day.
Jack McKee.
Hmm? Yes, I know. Have a seat.
Right. Murray Kaplan's done his best.
Well, that's right. You're in practice together.
Well, we get it right.
So what seems to be the trouble?
What? Nothing. I mean, I have a tickle. I've been hoarse.
Mm-hmm. Take a look. Cross your knees, sit back in the chair. Shut up, hands on your knees, chin forward. And open. Let's take a look. Close. Open. Right. Open. Might be a little bitter.
It's an anesthetic.
Want to take a closer look?
Whoa, a periscope.
Won't be pleasant. Tongue out. All the way. Huh? And hold it. Your hand. Head forward. And open. And again. 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 One more time. Doctor, you have a growth.
What?
Tumor, laryngeal. Here on the true vocal cord?
You know what laryngeal is.
Chest x-rays, blood chemistry, blood count, UA, EKG. Check with my secretary, but if it's remotely possible, I'd like to do a biopsy tomorrow. Okay?
Thanks.
Don't mention it.
Let's just hold him there for a moment. What do you think's going on in his mind? What is he feeling at the moment? Anybody want to take a fear? Just shout it out.
Shock.
Denial. Anger. Anger's probably coming, but it's there sort of looking around. Anything else? Bewilderment. I beg your pardon? Expecting sympathy. Disbelief. Very much alone at that moment. I want you to think about those in terms of what it feels like when somebody is disconnected from where they are at that moment, when they get this message of a painful message delivered in such a way that there isn't much sympathy, there isn't much connection that allows this person to be there. Would you want him to operate on you that day or the next day? Probably not. Probably not. That's my point, is when you get into the situation where the pain turns toxic, and there isn't any way to kind of get in. The person goes into the pain and away from the intellectual and emotional focus on work. When I got my message, I had gone in, I'd had skin melanoma that several years later showed up as a bump on my neck, and I went in for a checkup, an annual checkup, and the guy said, well, as you hear in airplanes, in the unlikely event, we're just going to take a biopsy. And it was a Friday afternoon, and then the oncologist said to me, In the unlikely event that this is anything, could you come next Friday and meet with the team? And I said, no, I'm too busy. I've got far too many things to do. I've got all these things. I'm such a busy person. And then I forgot all about it. And I went home, and I talk about this in the prologue of the book. I got this call. Nola, my wife, and I were going out for a walk. I picked up the phone, and the guy says, Dr. Frost, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have cancer. In your lymph nodes, you'll have to see your oncologist on Monday and make an appointment for his surgeon to take the lymph nodes out. Have a nice weekend. No, he didn't. He didn't. Didn't say that. But he did deliver the message. Well, you know, it's the message. He needed to give it to me. That does not then make you rush upstairs to write another research article or to get ready to do more teaching. It changes everything for that period of time. So that notion of disconnection is part of the important notion about what toxins and toxin handling and the results of those kinds of things have to do with. Now, let me take it away from the hospitals. We've been sort of in there for quite some time. A lot of my research has been around managers, and many of them were middle managers and more senior managers, but this is from a CEO who gave me this story and talked about his experiences in this company. He was the CEO of this company. It had a head office in the United States. He was located in Australia. And the company and the head office, the company itself that he was running, had gone through two mergers. There'd been change in leadership at the top at the head office. The market was going to hell. And the head office was demanding high yield all the time. Wasn't interested in the situation whatsoever. And he describes this one moment where he says, I remember coming into a quarterly outlook meeting and people had their heads in their hands. They were not able in their experience to meet the target that was being put there. And then he talks about this VP, and he made the point of saying, this is a very strong VP who broke down in tears in his office as this happened. The sequence of this is he's a handler. He'll show up a bit later in the story, and was trying to keep everybody going and keep the pain manageable. But eventually, people started to leave, and before they left, you know what they must have been doing is polishing their resumes and thinking about other things. They were not thinking about their work so much anymore, and he eventually left. And so again, you've got this experience taken away from the hospitals now into the notion of what happens when people are in pain, and that pain sends them to the point of despair or lack of hope or lack of confidence. And I think that what happens with toxic experiences is that they disrupt the creative workflow. That doctor couldn't think creatively about his surgery. I couldn't think, if I do at all creatively, about the kinds of things I'm doing. And there was an interesting study in the, I think it was New England Journal of Medicine, of a group of people who were suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease. And they separated them out into two categories, people who were depressed and those who clearly seemed to be hopeless. And they asked both of those groups, if euthanasia was legal, would you take it? And it was only the hopeless group that said yes. It was only the hopeless group. They no longer were interested in staying the course of what they were doing. And so, again, to repeat it again, that the notion is that we're talking about the loss of esteem. I like this quote because I think it speaks to it again. When your heart is broken, your head doesn't work right. And now we come to the issue of, well, why is this going on? One way to think about it is that when we're dealing with the challenges and demands that we have in organizations today, whether they're public or private, or profit or not for profit, the human issues tend to get moved into abstractions and numbers so that we can do something with them. We can get the scope of what we're doing, the scale of what we're doing. The problem is that you forget the human in there, and then when you've done the analysis, you forget to put the human back in. And so a lot of what happens that's delivered to us in organizations is maybe rational, but it doesn't pick up on the emotional needs that are existing in organizations. I'm going to skip over there and just give you this one point. There's lots of data I have in the book about the link between the bottom line and this toxicity, but this one I think says it very well, and it's from the CEO of Marriott. If you just think about how many of us are in the service game in organizations, you can build the best hotel in the best location with the best rooms and the best lobby, but if the service stinks and the employees don't care, customers won't come back. So if people are hurting and disconnected, it's going to impact on the way what we're trying to deliver in our organizations is experienced. And that goes for a lot of different organizations. So let me go into some of the sources of toxicity. I've called them the seven deadly sins. You know, when you're writing a book, you have to have sometimes a bit of a hook, and it's not the seven deadly sins, but it's the seven deadly sins. And the first five in there, intention, incompetence, through to intrusiveness, tend to be around people. The next one about institutional is more at the organizational level, and then there's a certain amount of pain that, as I said earlier, is inevitable. So let me just pick a couple of these and talk about them. There are practices and there are managers who, and not only managers, but I'm talking about managers here, who seem to believe that the way in which you get work done is to inflict fear and pain into people, and that's how they work. And so it's a malicious, intentional desire to make people hurt in order to get them to work. And it's been around for a long time, but I think it's still around, surprisingly, as we go. And I have one story that was given to me by a manager in New Jersey who talked about another manager in an organization who'd been very successful for some time as a manager and continued beyond the story. But this manager had in his office two fish bowls. In one fish bowl were goldfish, and the other were piranhas. You know what piranhas are? You put your finger in, you no longer have a finger. Okay. And he had each of the people in his team or his organization identify with one of the goldfish and give it a name and pay attention to it and say hello in the mornings and whatever. And then if they screwed up, he'd have them take the goldfish, you know where I'm going, and feed it to the piranhas. Now that's a degradation. I actually see people writing that down, so you know, I won't make any comment about whether that's appropriate or not. But it's a symbol of a style of management that I think, you know, you get the picture of what is malicious in that case. More frequently, what it is somebody at a senior level, and often the tone of an organization is set from the top very often. So you do get the sense of if a CEO is doing that kind of thing, then the people below pick up the cues and it goes on through the organization. The same is thankfully true, that if the tone is set positive, that can have a positive and a healthy effect in the organization. But more often, it looks like somebody who comes in and picks on somebody in the group and harangues that person or harasses that person as a signal to everybody that they better shape up. In terms of incompetence, I think the issue here is that in many organizations we promote people to positions of leadership on the basis of their technical competence, not on their ability to work with people as well. And so they rise up through the organization as good financial people, good marketing people, whatever it is, technology people. And if they are not good at the people side of things, it's usually brushed aside if it's even noticed. And so they get to the point where they're working with people under them, and they do things like they micromanage. They cannot give anybody an assignment and not be on their backs all the time. Or they keep changing their minds, or they play favorites. There are a lot of different ways in which they do that. Now, I will say that each of us as managers, when we're in that role, will have a bad hair day, and we'll do these kinds of things. But it's the pathological over-emphasis of this kind of style that leads to a lot of distress and a lot of pain and a lot of toxicity in many situations. The third one, in infidelity, sometimes when you're trying to get the seven deadly sins, you have to work a little bit. The infidelity here has to do with betrayal of trust. Betrayal of trust. And you have examples in the studies of stories about managers who have an unspoken agreement with somebody that they will be looked after in a circumstance, and when the time comes, it's lost. It never happens. Or somebody gives a confidence to a manager, and that confidence is betrayed around the organization. Or a manager gets a good idea from his or her co-workers or subordinates and takes that and peddles it to more senior management as their idea. And one of the things that I've noticed in the interviews and in looking at these situations is that quite often your toxic managers are very good at looking good up, but not down. You get inside the observation of it, you see where the pain is. But when you look at them from on top, by the people who've hired them, it doesn't show up quite as much. And then the last one that I wanted to, the last two there, the emotional unintelligence is simply people who don't get it when people are in pain. They don't get a feel for that, and so there's a lost opportunity to deal with it. And the intrusiveness, there's a lot of discussion in the field of leadership about the role of charisma, of attractiveness, and I think that part of that attractiveness has a real positive image. People like to work with somebody that they feel inspired by. But when people take that charismatic capacity and manipulate people to do things that they don't need necessarily to do, simply to please that charismatic ego, that can cause a lot of pain in organizations, a lot of frustration, because it's hard to deal with. Now, very briefly onto the institutional, there are ways in which the policies and practices of organizations don't account for people. That technical equation that forgets human beings in it can create that. There are all kinds of policies that do that and practices. Organizations that have no vision, organizations that have competing visions, a number of different other ways that that goes. And then the last one on here, inevitability. You have the traumas of things like 9/11, you have the jolts of the market, and you have leadership, again, as I'm going to point out a bit later, that inevitably creates a certain amount of pain. So let me then just give you the fact that it's not just from the top down. This toxicity can come from clients, it can come from employees, it can come from co-workers. There are a lot of different places. I happen to have focused on managers in this situation. But here's the toxic co-worker. You wouldn't believe what people are saying about you. I tried to defend you. I said you only look slow only because you're bloated. But what ticked me off is that everyone in the department earns more than you do. You know, hands up anybody here who's had an encounter with a toxic coworker that looks like that. Okay. So what is it that's going on in here that is that transforms the pain into toxicity? And I think these are some of the things that we might think about. We don't see the pain because we're going too fast. We blow right by it. Why? Because we've got 10 things to do in the next hour, we've got a meeting to go to, we've got other things to do, and the cadence of pain, unless it's traumatic, tends to go at a different cadence than the speed that we're going at. I think if it's traumatic, it goes faster than you are, and you have to pay attention to it. But a lot of the pain sits there and turns toxic, and we're too busy, we're going too fast, we don't pick it up. And so one of the key things in the handling is that they do, in fact, notice that. The second thing we have is that we don't hear it. We're too busy telling somebody how we would solve the problem instead of listening to what they have to say. We don't feel it. We don't have that pickup. We don't have that emotional attunement. We're either numbed by everything we have to do in an organization, or we're numbed because that's the way you get to the top in the organization, or we're numbed because we've seen so much of this that we can't deal with it anymore. We don't know what to do with it. This goes back to the competence of handling pain in organizations. We see it, it's presented, but we don't know quite what to do with it, so we're stymied. Interestingly enough, I think often just being there, and I'll come to in a moment, and just being present for the person can make a difference. And lastly, we don't care. It doesn't matter to us whether you feel in pain, suck it up, I've got pain too, let's go from there. So those are some things to think about in terms of pain. And let's go to a more positive, change it around to what happens. Margaret Somerville is an ethicist at McGill University, and she wrote a book called The Ethical Canary, which is a book about how we have people out there who are testing the issues we're facing with, and what happens to them may tell us what happens in society. And she has this comment, hope is the oxygen of the human spirit. And so bringing hope to hopeless situations, like the nurse did in the first story I mentioned to you, I think is a really important part of this. And for that to happen, we have to take the time. One of the problems with working with pain in relationships or pain in organizations or pain in families is that it requires us to stop and take the time. And Edward Hallowell is a psychiatrist who wrote in the Harvard Business Review about his experiences with senior managers who had all the technology going around them but never had the time to make the connections with the people that they were involved in. And there's nothing in this that says technology isn't a helpful thing. It's just that the technology and the pace that we live at is, again, the reason we don't have these human moments. And he argues that you don't need a long moment, but you need the moment. And then he points out the things that we need to think about. You've got to turn the phone off. You've got to turn the computer down. You've got to stop daydreaming. You've got to look at other things and put them aside so you can focus on the person. And so a great deal of what is at the core of toxin handling is the capacity to take this human moment at work and deal with it. Now, that's an image from the Harvard Business Review article I first wrote on the toxin handlers. And it's an interesting picture. It was deliberately chosen by the journal as a man carrying the person. And the cover of the book has a man dealing with pain. And the reason that they did that, and I was very supportive of it, is that there's a real danger when we talk about the toxin handling we're going to go to and working with people's pain, that it's seen as woman's work. Interestingly enough, most of the people in my sample of managers and the people who've brought me stories are men. But the issue is not to marginalize it and say, oh, well, that's the human resource department's job, or that's a woman manager, she can look after that. It's a job that's done by project managers, line managers often, and in many cases, they do it for two reasons. They pick up on the pain and they feel it, and they know that if people are hurting, they won't get the job done. So they step in often quite both from, if you like, partly altruistically, but also instrumentally, so that they can get the work done that needs to be done. And so that's a sort of an image of somebody doing the work of the toxin handler. An image that I like about it is that it's in between. It's between the source of the pain and the person. It's the stepping in. Many of the people I interviewed gave me words like, I feel like I'm a bridge, or I'm a modem, or I'm a connector. Those kinds of things as the way that that goes. And the kinds of things that they do, the competencies of toxin handling, go at their root to the aspect of listening to pain. It is a core competency in being able to handle. People who do that, they listen, and that may be all that needs to happen, as I said earlier. You may just need to be there so somebody can vent. And then when you start to go out around that, there are some things that the handlers do, and many of you who've identified with this may find yourself in one or other of these places. The holding space aspect of it is a very important one, because I think that a lot of what happens when people are in pain is they don't need you to heal them, and you're not competent to do that anyway. They just need space to breathe. And one of the stories that I got from a manager, actually she was an MBA student in one of my classes, was of an experience she had working in a bank. And she came to work one Monday to be told by the branch manager that her supervisor had died on the weekend, and he was in his middle 30s, late 30s. They'd played volleyball with him. They knew him well. And there was the shock of him of dying on the weekend. And the manager then gave them, the branch manager gave them a little bit of time to kind of adjust, and he did some things to help the day go by. But the key holding space that he did that I think makes an illustration of this well is the funeral took place a few days later, and the staff wanted to go to the funeral. Well, the company policy said, you can go to the funeral if you can replace with replacement workers, and then you need to come back to work. Well, the replacement workers was easy, but except that the manager believed that these people needed more time, and what they needed to do, in his judgment, was to have the day off, but have a lunch between the funeral and the afternoon. That's how he envisaged it. Now, of course, the policy said you can't do that, so handlers often have to use political capital to fight the battles they do need to do in order to get things done. But they had the lunch, and the way in which it was told to me was this MBA student who'd been there said, the lunch was an amazing experience. First of all, they had time to honor the person who died. But then they began to talk to one another about themselves and what the meaning of life was and whatever else was going on, and it was a very healing lunch. And then they went home, and she said when they came back the next day, he had not been at the lunch. He had been at the office clearing out that office and changing the way things looked so that when they came back the next day, everything was able to move forward. And she said two things. We were amazingly healed by that. And secondly, if I'm a manager one day, that's what I would like to be able to do, is to have that capacity. You and I can only imagine also how much pain he was carrying if he was also the person who knew the supervisor. But his job there was holding space. I'm not going to go in detail around all of them. The other one I want to mention is buffering. And handlers do a lot of buffering. They keep the pain away from the people below them or around them. And so if you've got hostile instructions from the top or you've got bad news that doesn't need to be told quite that way, the handler will pick up that and transform the message. So if the message coming down from the top is, there are a bunch of idiots out there, get them to get things done quickly or I will have punishment all round, the message comes through, we've got a target to go for. Let's work on it. Let's get going. The pain stops at the handler. So that's a place, and a lot of that gets done, I think, in many situations. Extricating is often the case of you have to be more proactive and get somebody who's promising out of a toxic place and in another place. And I have some stories there of very successful experiences of getting people who had promise out of unpromising situations and allowing them to develop in a better way. And transforming is really talking about the fact that often we can't change what's going on, but we can change the way people see it. And that gives them a way to move forward. And the last aspect of it that I think is important is modeling. I have one manager in my sample who had a heart attack, and he said, is this a terribly maudlin talk tonight? Everything's heart attacks, cancers, and things. But we are talking about toxins. And this man had been, he was a head of a manufacturing part for Intel, had a heart attack in the midst of handling very, very complicated issues and a lot of tensions in the organization. And I saw his story in Fast Company, and I eventually tracked him down and did the interview with him. And he said, I had a family predisposition to heart attacks, but I have no doubt that the stress and the difficulty and the pain I was carrying in this situation was a factor in what was happening. And he said, now when I've gone back to Intel, I make it a conscious matter with my staff, with myself, to model a calmer, more considerate, more slower paced, as much as I can, operation, so people can learn from me and I can show them what needs to happen. Well, those are some of the things that the handlers do. But I want to also talk about what happens to the handlers. And when I first started playing with these ideas, I had been thinking about them, and I was giving a seminar to about 30 managers who were in a three-week residential program here in the Faculty of Commerce, and very, very productive people, very high-flying people. And at the end of one of my sessions, just before lunch, I had 10 minutes of free. And I thought, well, let me just talk about these ideas with them. Let me tell you the sorts of things that I've been telling you. It wasn't as clearly or as fully articulated. I don't know if it's clear. But I started to talk about these ideas to the group in the seminar, and it was dead silence. And I had this awful moment that teachers have, which is, oh God, it's been all junk. Nobody wants to listen. I've wasted 10 minutes. Thank God it's only 10 minutes and we can go to lunch. But then I said to them, oh, by the way, it's one of those things you do when you're trying to recover. But I was interested. If any of you are interested in this and would like to talk to me about it, I'm going to be here for a few minutes afterwards. I'm starting to do some research in this area. And if you think it's nuts, tell me. If you think it's interesting, tell me. And we stopped. Just the bell. Time to go. Okay. I was mobbed. I was mobbed. I didn't get to lunch. So many of the managers came forward and said, have I got a story for you? And we actually did, over that period of time, a number of interviews. I was working with a colleague, Sandra Robinson. But the stories were very poignant and very full, and these were from successful managers. And in other interviews I've done with managers, when they come forward, they talk about what they've done, and then they talk about the painful experiences that have happened to them, and some of them cry. And I'm not just talking about, you know, again, it's the strong manager, but beginning to talk and having great capacity to remember the incidents that they were dealing with. So there's a feature here that I think that happens when you're doing the handling. That is that if you're doing it over and over again, and handlers, in my experience, are reckless with themselves. They may be very, very good at working with other people and helping other people, but when it comes to themselves, they don't seem to be able to help themselves. So that there is a danger in doing this. It's a little bit like going into battle with a plastic fork, you know, going into that situation. So there's a lot of burnout. There was a study done some time ago where a group of healthy people were given two tasks, and their immune system measure of IgA, secretory immunoglobulin, was measured, having them first think about something negative, a negative emotion, and then later a positive emotion. And this immunoglobulin is something in the immune system which, if it goes up, it protects and helps activate the immune system. When people were given just the simple task of thinking about a negative emotion that they'd experienced, the first brief moment was the immunoglobulin went up, and then it went down for 3 or 4 or 5 hours, which meant that it was not helping the immune system, just on some emotional thinking. When they were done later with the positive thoughts, the immunoglobulin IgA went up and stayed up for several hours. You can see the impact of that. If you think about handlers who are in the midst of toxins over and over again, not just thinking about it, it tends to seep in. And one of the tests, I think, it's sort of an informal test, is if you find yourself constantly waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is when the circadian rhythm tends to go, and thinking and role-playing out all these things over and over again, it may be that you can solve them, but eventually you start to wear down. And so there is a great deal of wear and tear on handlers that they don't have the means to protect themselves from. The other aspect of it is that they're not trained. They sometimes have an agenda to help, which may not be the best thing to do over time. And if the issue is wanting to be loved, then you have another issue, which is the issue of doing this for a good-hearted reason, but not necessarily the right reason in an organization. And then inside the organization, the last thing I want to talk about here is there's not a lot of support for this. If imagine yourself in this situation, that you are a handler, and we haven't got the terminology to talk about it yet, so we're looking back a little bit from this time, and you are doing these things of handling, and often when people are handlers, lots of people come to them. And you come home at the end of the day, and your partner says to you, so what did you do today, dear? And you say, well, a lot of Kleenex, you know. I can't quite tell you what I did. And compare that with coming home having done the budget well or got a project lane, and you come home and they say, what have you done? Well, we got the budget. There hasn't been a language to express this work that's done because it didn't seem like work. It seems like stuff you do, and then you have to do the real work afterwards. And so there's a lot of guilt, there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of pain that's built into the fact that organizations don't want to see this, or if they see it, they don't want to know about it, and they don't want to deal with it in any way that is productive. So all of these things create the kinds of problems that are there. Now, again, in the time that we have, I just want to go to a couple of things. And again, it'll be short, but let me just focus on a few things. There was some work done by these two gentlemen on high-performance athletes, Jim Lohr and Tony Schwartz. They published an article on the making of a corporate athlete. And they had been working for years with high-performing athletes. And what they observed as they were working with these athletes is that they put in enormous pressure and enormous effort, and then they did their performance, and then they rested. And then they do another push, and then they'd rest. But their durability came from the capacity to work really hard and then take a break. And then they went to look at senior managers, or any managers for my money, but they were looking at senior managers. And they looked at these managers and they saw the following. High performance. And then what? High performance. And then what? High performance. There's no break in there. There's no break in there. Their argument is it isn't the stress that gets you, it's the lack of oscillation between the stress and the downside of that. And so they have this lovely comment, the key to sustained health and performance is to establish rituals that promote oscillation and recovery. And we don't do that very well in organizations. But my feeling, building on some of their work and then doing some research of my own on people we identified as handlers who were seeming to be surviving well, was that there's a need to build capacity. These two gentlemen have this as a hierarchy. I think that these are just different arenas to work in, where to protect oneself as a handler, we need to build up our physical capacity, and that might just be as simple as learning to breathe, which is what we don't do very well when we're under pressure, or doing a fitness campaign or a change of something like that. In the emotional side, it may be just trying to get clear that you do need some space, having some personal space put in, having some breaks in the system, having a sanctuary that you can go to. In the mental side of it, it may be the capacity to say no and learn to say no, train oneself to say no, not take these things on. And in the spiritual side, however you want to take that, it has to do with why are you doing these things? What are your values in why you're trying to do something? And can you build a perception that is bigger than just being caught in the trenches? You know, how should I live my life knowing that I will die one day? You know, what is your life value? When people were on the planes in 9/11 phoning home on their cell phones, one of the messages they gave was we're being or whatever. What was the other message? I love you. It wasn't, could you postpone the meeting for a week? Or I'll get to that budget or I can, or could somebody else do it? It had to do with these fundamental values that come out when we're under pressure. Well, having some kind of a game plan that addresses those things becomes an important part, I think, of helping heal the handler, protect the handler. But it's not enough. That's a little bit like in a war, patching up the soldiers and sending them back into the situation without having anything other to help them with. And so from the field that I'm in organizations and organizational studies, there comes the notion of, well, what do you do back at the job? And again, I'll just mention one or two of them here. Naming the experience, even being able to name that this is handling and it is reasonable work, takes that pressure of, well, I've got something that I can point to that I do that's valuable to the organization. Managing how we say that so it links in with what other people think is important, and having support networks in the organization so that you have other people. There's a certain loneliness to this job that, again, compounds the stress that's in there. And then what can organizations do? Well, I think it's a question of being able to acknowledge this. One of my purposes of working in this area is for self-interest is to create a research agenda, but a more important one to me is to get this on the agenda of organizations, to get this in front of people who have the power to make a difference so that it can be discussed. To offer support, sometimes you've got to pull the handlers to safe zones and do it in a way that leaves them with their self-respect, and to do the modeling and to create a culture that allows that to happen. I'm just going to use this one, look at the time that we're on, and maybe say a couple more things, and the rest of it can come from questions if you like. But one of the things I did, I met with a man who was the president of the American Psychological Association, Martin Seligman, and he was we were talking about this work, and he said, you know, what you really need to do is to talk to some people who actually handle toxic waste. And he said, I know the man who's the CEO of one of the major companies in the United States, and here's his number, give him a call. Sometimes you get breaks like that allow you to get into situations. And so I, you know, to cut a long story short, I eventually ended up interviewing several of the frontline supervisory workers for this company, two or three of them who had been working on the anthrax scare around 9/11. So they'd been in New York and dealt with those kinds of things. And they had read some of my work, and so we had a common ground to talk. And there was a lot of overlap. They could understand what I was talking about in terms of toxicity in the terms I'm using. But they said, you know, when we do these things, we have systems to protect our workers. We never send somebody in alone. We'll often have one buddy or a couple of buddies that will go in. We never send them out with a plastic fork. We send them out with protection. It's either the clothing they wear or the material around them. We always research the issue so that we know what's going on as best we can. And we always have somebody looking out for them so that if people get caught up in this handling, which you can often get caught up in and not know that how many hours have gone by, that it's time to get out, pull them out. And so their argument is that you really need a systemic approach to handling these kinds of things to help people deal with what is really a very dangerous issue. This is dangerous. So is the handling of emotions in organizations dangerous. It's very necessary. I would hope that you wouldn't go away with a message that we shouldn't do this stuff, but it really does require some attention to it. And the comment that I thought was really powerful to their toxins and to the way I'm talking about toxins is that if you leave it around too much, a lot of people get damaged, a lot of people get hurt. So let me then go to maybe one more idea, and then we'll kind of go to a close. I mentioned at the beginning that if we move away from just handlers and put it into the context of organizations as such, that leaders create pain. And I think that this is one of the most important things that we can perhaps get across to leaders, that if you are creating the pain, what do you do to prevent it or to mop it up afterwards? There's a story I have. It was an interview in the Wall Street Journal of an event that happened with a manager in Canada whose wife had died, and he had two children, and he worked for GE, and GE had made the decision at this point to move him to Europe. And he looked at the situation and said, I can't leave. I've got a family here. The kids are little. They've just lost their mother. I'll quit. And it wasn't acrimonious. He just said, that's it. I'll quit. Well, Jack Welch, who's not known for his compassion necessarily, but nevertheless was doing what I think is an important leadership act here, heard about this, picked up the phone, phoned him and said, look, come down to the head office. I'd like to talk to you about it. Flew him into the head office. And the first thing he said to this man, according to the report, was, we screwed up, didn't we? We screwed up. And I'm sorry. Now, what can we do for you to keep you in the organization and keep you in Canada? You don't have to go to Europe. It's a silly idea. And the story follows up with him going back to Canada, eventually being the CEO of GE in Canada, and now he's moved to another organization. But that's that point of the leader being able to pick up on the pain and deal with it and fix it. You can't always, as a leader, anticipate what's going to happen. But it's that reflection back and saying, what do I need to do with this in order to make a difference and to handle the pain? And the leader does it with so much more power and resource than does somebody else who's doing it informally. My other comment in here came from somebody who does a lot of work with healing groups, which I thought was very powerful, which is that there's always grief somewhere in the room. And one of the arguments I'm making in the book is that this lens of pain, this lens of grief, allows you to look at the organization in a different way and see some things you wouldn't normally see. So as the last example I'll use in here to kind of to go that far, and then let's take some questions if you like. I have a case in the book talking about a manager who was dealing with two subordinates who were at each other's throats. They were fighting with one another, and his diagnosis of it was, well, they can't listen to each other. So he arranged for them to go on a good listening seminar, you know, one day, 2 day, whatever it would be. And then he happened to come across the Harvard Business Review article I'd written on this originally on toxin handlers. And he said a light went on. He said, I suddenly thought, what's really going on in here? And I went back and I sat down with each one of them and I said, why are you feeling this? What is happening? Is there any pain around the situation that's going on for you? And the one person said, yes, I get no respect around here. And I'm trying to do things in a creative way, and this other person is constantly, you know, degrading me or damaging my self-esteem, whatever. And he went to the other person and she said, you know, I am carrying all the load in this organization. I carry the work. I have to do all the extra work. I do all these things. Nobody ever gives me any acknowledgement for it. I'm carrying an incredible amount of administrative load here and I'm sick of it. And what he said is by going in that zone and looking at that, he had a completely different diagnosis and a different set of solutions as to how to solve the problem by looking at it through that lens. And so that's part of the message, I think, that we look at it, the leadership and the organization that way. I'm going to skip through here and go to the final slide. We're back in a hospital setting. These were two twins born in the mid-1990s. They were premature twins, Kiri and I forget the other name off the top of my head. But they had been born, they were put into separate incubators, and one of these twins was doing very well. High color, good health symptoms. The other one was not doing well at all. She was blue, she had bad breathing rates, she had bad heart rates, And the nurse, whose name was Gail Casperian, who is my handler in this story, noticed that, and she remembered that she had seen in an article in Europe that when premature babies are born, if you think about where they've come from, it's better to put them in a single incubator because that continues the environment that they've experienced before. And so she went to the hospital and the policy said, no, we don't do that. So she had to fight that battle. Again, this is often what handlers have to do. But she won her way, and they may have won it easier, I don't know. She put them in the incubator together, and almost immediately, the one who was ill started to settle down. The color came back, the breathing came back, the heart rate settled down. And now they are happy and healthy people living, children, preschoolers. I guess if it's 96, they're probably 8 or 9 now. They live in the Massachusetts area. So I like to sort of have that as a sort of maybe a close for this part of it, because it says a number of things to me. One is it shows the handling role. Secondly, it shows how important that reconnection is, the connection and reconnection. Because without that connection, we have that sense of hopelessness. We have none of the things that may help us move forward in a constructive way and be productive as we go. And I just think that these are some of the images we need to take with ourselves as we go forward in trying to do some things to take some of the toxicity out of the workplace. We will never take it all out. It's like an organism. We create toxins and we have kidneys and livers to deal with that. But if they get overloaded, we get sick. And in organizations where we have some handlers as individuals, we may even have departments that do that. Interestingly enough, they're the ones that get cut first in downtimes. But the issue I think here is that we can make some differences by doing the kinds of things that we're paying attention to and protecting those who do it. So let me shut up and say that. Yeah. Okay. Okay, where do whistleblowers fit into the thing? That's a very, very good question. I think they fulfill some of the function that we've been talking about, which is there is pain in the system, there's something wrong in the system. Usually many people know that that's so, but are afraid to speak up or have vested interest not to speak up. And so I think the toxin handler is a release mechanism in the system we're talking about to try to release the toxins. Interestingly enough, if you talk about the dangers to handling, that's probably one of the most dangerous things that can be done. The track record, as far as I know, of handlers, of whistleblowers surviving is not very good. The system turns on the whistleblower. So it's an excellent comment. I think that fits into that notion of serves a function, but the body rejects it at a certain point. What I'm talking about is, thank you for that. The question, I think everybody got it, is what about handlers at other levels? I chose to focus on a particular arena because that was where I was going with the data and finding it out. And so it was at managers, but at several levels. I gave you a CEO, and others were at branch managers and different managers at different levels. But I do believe it's a mechanism that plays out all through the organization. And some of the most memorable handlers are probably people who are at the secretary level or at the floor or co-workers. There are people because it is a mechanism. Somebody feels the pain, observes the pain, notices the pain, which is a really important part of what I think is there, and then works in a particular way to kind of smooth it out or to help people heal. And that can happen at any level. So I don't want to just be thought of as at the management level. Okay. So the comment is, would it be better to have more of a military model of clearly defined roles? I'm not sure that there wasn't a great deal of need for handling in those kinds of organizations, too. I think the issue of the day is that I think the nature of the world we live in at the moment requires more ambiguity and more flexibility in the organizations. That's part of the nature we deal with, that being able to define something very, very specifically for people often works when you have a defined environment, you know, you can predict it, you know where you're going. But as you move away from that, even in military systems, I think, where you have a more unexpected terrain, where you have much more flexibility required, those roles become more intertwined. And that's not to say that that isn't a part of the problem. It's just that I think that's the world we live in now. I think that if you could get more clarity about the fact that responsibility for managers is to be responsible for some of these issues, you wouldn't have it being needing to be so sort of in the moment, having to be fixed by a few people who take it on in addition to everything else they're doing. So I think clarity would help. I'm not sure we can ever get back to that clarity in the world that we live in. Right. Right. Yes. Yeah, I have a whole a chapter on what organizations can and do.
Repeat the question.
I'm sorry. The question was, do I have any examples of organizations that do this in a more formalized, institutionalized way, as opposed to the issue of just people stepping in and doing it? And the answer is yes. I have a whole chapter on what organizations can and do. And one of the organizations that most of us would know here that fits that very well is Southwest Airlines. And what Southwest Airlines does as an example, and I'm glad you asked the question because it allows me to just flesh out one of the parts I didn't talk about in the talk, is they do, if you think about this again in organism terms and system terms, effective organizations keep the toxins out where they can. They deal with it when it's in there effectively, and then they deal with what I would call the recovery time. Because it's one thing to go in and have surgery, but the healing process doesn't end with the surgery. It ends with the post-operative and the post-hospital time and so on and so forth. And what Southwest Airlines does very well is it creates an understanding that runs a very efficient shop, so it runs its finances very well, but it also puts people first. And when they are hiring, if they're going to bring in a pilot, they will have pilots within the organization sitting in on those kinds of decisions. And if they spot something in the people who are coming in, no matter how good they are technically, that doesn't fit with what they consider healthy functioning, they won't take them. So an example was they had, and one of the ones I have in the book is, they had an opportunity to hire this fantastic pilot, who'd be the test pilot and everything else. And during the course of the interviews, they noticed that he was very brilliant in what he was talking about, but he was very dismissive of people, and particularly people in the lower ranks in the audience, the receptionists and so on. They didn't hire him. Now, you want them to hire a pilot who can fly the plane, right? Not just somebody who smiles. But the point is that they take a great deal of pains to try to keep the toxins out. They have systems inside the organization that celebrate good work, that create some time for humor, which again is something of a healing aspect. And when things go wrong, as they did in 9/11, they're the only company, the only airline that didn't lay, well, Alaska was the other one, that did not lay people off, that went in front of their people, their top management, and said, we value who you are, we're going to keep flying, we won't lay off, and we're taking no pay for the next X number of whatever it was. So there are ways of fairness, of treating people with dignity, and creating systems to do that then you don't require, you're still going to have the handler. I don't think you're ever going to get rid of the need for handlers, but you can put it in a context that's much healthier.
Question over here.
Where does the business handling fall in a unionized setting?
Where does the business of handling fall in a unionized setting? Again, I think that's a very important question. If you think about institutionalized mechanisms for handling pain, one possible place for that in an organization is human resource department. The issue for them, by the way, is I think that as human resource departments have become so focused on the resource part of human resources in order to be able to show that they make a contribution to the team, the bottom line, that they've forgotten the human side of the human resources. And to the extent that they put the human back in, they have an opportunity to play this role very well. Not all of them, but some do, and as an institution. Interestingly enough, as I said earlier, in times of difficulty, that's often a department that's cut when you really need that mechanism when there's times of stress. So then we go to unions, and I think the issue here is I think the union mechanism is another handling mechanism. It was designed originally, if you think about it, to bring fairness back into the system, to counteract the power of management, to deal with unfair, a whole lot of things that were, I think, very toxic in organizations. So I think when unions are operating in an effective way, they fulfill that function. I think that often the people who have to do that in the unions suffer the same kinds of issues that I've talked about. I had a really poignant email just after the book came out from somebody somewhere in the United States who said, I've been a union rep for 26 years. I wish I'd read this when I started. He said, you have no idea the pain that I've carried as we go through. So I don't think we can say, you know, I've been pretty hard on managers and hard on organizations, but and we do need to redress that. But I think this capacity to create pain and handle it exists in all kinds of organizations, and unions are organizations too.
Over there?
I think you heard the question. Heck. Pardon? I'm not going there. I'm not going there. I think that, let me just take this. I do think that the deck is stacked against the handlers in many organizations, regardless of whether there are psychopaths running the shop or not. I think it's a very difficult job because it is, in many ways, not even malevolently, I think we are so driven in competition, and we're so driven by a system that requires us to be almost the survival of the fittest, that somebody who comes along and says, let's take some time out in this system and let's do some things that might be around people rather than product, that is a very difficult thing to do. So I think the deck is stacked all the time, and I think that's part of the problem that handlers get into. But I think that there are the boardroom, as best I would say, I don't disagree with that observation. I just think that there are some that are like that. There are some that I think if I were inside the boardroom of Southwest Airlines or other organizations like that, and some of the ones I talk about in the book, I don't think that would be true. I think the problem is that the whole notion of leadership in organizations can draw people in for whom the notion of power and the notion of control is a very big part of what makes them tick. And that in a boardroom with the powers that are given in there, there is a real opportunity to run rampant with that. I think that the current emphasis to try to get us back to boards of that will be more responsive and be more alert to the transgressions of senior management is probably a very healthy thing. Because in the absence of that, if there is any tendency to power and dominance, it can run rampant. So I don't think all CEOs are psychopaths. But I think that it's an arena where that kind of thing can certainly play out.
Question here, and then there.
Okay, very good question. The question was, how do you read the annual reports of organizations that they put them out to get a sense of whether they really do care about people or not? And you used the DePasco comment of our product is of steel, but it's strength. and strengthen people. I think a lot of the time those are just words. It's just rhetoric. And people make this comment about, yes, people are important. But I think what I would be inclined to do would be to sort of see where do they, what resources do they provide for the development of their leaders, development of people in the organization, attention to career opportunities, attention to perhaps even, as I said earlier, a healthy focus on human resources. And I don't know in many reports that you see that. I think you'd have to go behind it. Most of it, you know, you have to ask yourself the question, what are those reports written for? They're written for shareholders, they're written for other audiences, and then they have this little line in, well, people are important. So I think you have to go behind those and ask those. If I were going to the board, I would ask some questions about what are you doing in those areas. I'm not quite sure the answer. The question is?
How often do you come across people who support the handlers?
Okay. They say they're handlers, but they're not.
Yes.
Okay. I don't have statistics on that. I do know that one of the tricky things in this whole area is that people may, if I were to ask a show of hands in an audience, say, how many of you think you're toxic handlers? A lot of hands go up, and that may be true. And then some of them may, first of all, not be handlers, but think they are. So you'd have to find out what other people say. And the other thing is that I think often handlers become toxic themselves because they are in it for so long. They're in it it's a slippery slope between, you know, doing this in order to help people, and then it becomes an addiction of wanting to do that, or some people I've talked about people who purport to be handlers or are handlers who can't get through the day unless somebody's given them something to work on. So I think there is a danger. But just to give a little bit of weight to your comment, I gave a talk on this topic a couple of years ago down when I was still building the ideas to a group of people in Australia, and it was a very lively group of senior managers. And we had this conversation about the handling, and I did the hands, how many hands, and so on. And this one person in the room was very excited about it and talked about it and talked about her handling capacities. And then we went for drinks, and a couple of people sidled up to me and said, she's the worst toxin, and she's the worst toxin. You know, she doesn't know anything about handling. All she does is deliver the toxins. So I think there in teasing this out from a research point of view or trying to answer that question, there are some tricky mixes. But we can be both toxic and handlers. And I think that the question there is probably the way to ask the question of what I'm doing, does it matter, is to ask, it's not about you. Who is it for? What are you trying to accomplish here? And if the thing is to help somebody, as the nurse did, or as in those situations where you genuinely want to help and deal with it, you're probably on safe ground. But if the handling is done because you want to be loved, or because it gives that adrenaline kick, then maybe one has to step back a little bit and go back up the slope to try to get to the point where it's more, I call it professional intimacy. Professional intimacy. It's somewhere between too intimate and too detached. And it's a real dance to kind of find that point in the middle. And you don't always keep it.
Woman here?
Right. Okay, the question was to go back to gender, to revisit my statement that I was surprised that there were men who did the handling as opposed to what we might say would be women. I don't know what I don't have any data on the difference. I do have a piece in the book. There's a psychologist researcher in California. His name is Shelley Taylor. She's done some wonderful work on, she works with AIDS patients, she works with a number of others, in terms of what does the power of positive illusion do for you, as opposed to delusion, or as opposed to being so realistic that you say, I can't live You know, it's that in-between place where if you have at least a positive regard for what you're doing, she seems to find data that has a positive outcome for people. But she's also done some research on the whole fight versus flight notion that we have with stress. And she found some differences between what she called flight and fight for men and stay and tend for women. I haven't got the terms quite right, but the basic notion was that not all women are like this, of course, but there is something in there about the fact that under stress conditions, women will stay to look after the children or look after the people around while the men rush off with their spears and do what, or run away or whatever it is that happens. That's a knock. Sorry. But I think, I'll just speculate here a little bit. I think that there is a training ground for women that starts very early that has to do with noticing pain and dealing with pain. Not for all women, and there are men who pick that up in their as they grow up as well. But I think that there is perhaps more of an understanding of what that is. But I think to go back to the fact that I found it in men, I think that we've underestimated the sensitivity aspect of men. It's had to be kept sort of off the table. A couple of the people I interviewed said, you can't talk about this stuff at work because you'd be laughed out of court. And I think that may be the organizational game may be made closer to what that is for men. But they have the capacity to do it. And I don't know whether there's a real difference other than maybe socialization experiences people are growing up.
We'll take only two more questions. Gentleman up here, and I saw one way up there. This one first.
Let me see if I got the question right. How do you handle when an organization is going into bankruptcy? And I missed the second part of that. They're in pain. So how do you have when people are in pain? Because it's shutting down? I think that what happens in a situation like that is you have to ask yourself the question, can you solve the problem in any other way than that it has to be going bankrupt? And the answer is no, from what you've described. So how do you help people let go in a dignified way? The issue is that sometimes in organizations, we have to shut it down, or we have to lay people off, or we have to take some hard decisions. The surgeon has to make a cut at some point, and a person might be terminal, and you have to deal with that. But if you take that analogy and say, can you do it in such a way that people leave feeling like they've made a contribution, that isn't their fault, that they have something to look forward to, that there's a connection out from here. And I think the problem that often happens is that people don't know what to do about that or can't get themselves around to look at it. And so it's a rough cut when people go. It's a rough bankruptcy. And I don't think there's any reason that we can't face that and have maybe a ritual that says we're letting go, which is one of the things I talk about in terms of when there's trauma and when you're dealing with it, is having something that symbolizes that we've had a good life and we're moving on. But it puts the human into the bankruptcy in a way that says, let's have dignity. We can't save the organization, but let's do it in a dignified way.
Last question.
Okay, I you got the question? No, the question the comment was what gets measured gets done, and if this doesn't show up in measures, how would it get done, and so what might we do in order to get attention to it in a way that would be significant rather than lip service, right? I think that it would be dangerous to build this into a routine. I think if you made this into a bureaucratic routine and you had T-shirts to go with it, it said, I'm a toxin handler. I'm just joking, but, you know, worse things have happened to ideas in the field of management. But I think if I went to an organization and said, you know, what are your managers doing to take care of their people? How does that show up? And it might need to be unique to the organization. And I'd say, if those are not delivered, we're going to have a conversation about this, and it's going to have some impact on what you get at the end of the day. I mean, I had one last example, just to sort of maybe punch that point home. I had a senior manager tell the following story, that he heard secondhand about one of his managers who fired a next line manager down by having everybody go to a meeting and then put the organization chart up on the PowerPoint and leave that person's name off. That's how the person was fired. Okay? Well, the senior manager got to hear about this and called the manager in and said, I understand you let Jones go. And he said, yes. He said, how did you do that? And he explained. He said, well, why did you do it that way? He said, well, I just thought it was painless and less, you know, whatever. And he said, well, actually, no, and you're gone. And I'm sure he did it kindly, you understand, since he was trying to make a point. That's why I'm pushing the leadership and organization so much. Unless there's a modeling of it and an accountability, if not in numbers, at least in, you know, let's have a reporting of what's doing, you're not going to get the change. And the organizations that do it right do have those kinds of things in there. Okay.
I'm going to ask Dr. Mark Thompson, Professor Emeritus in the Faculty of Commerce, to say thank you to Dr. Frost.
When I first saw the subject matter of tonight's presentation, I confess the first thought that went through my mind was, Peter and I have shared a workplace for over 20 years. Would I recognize any names or situations? And I broached this to Peter earlier in the week, and he assured me that we were all safe. And indeed, I can confirm that I at least did not recognize any situations in which we were involved. The workplace has not been studied much in the field of management. It's been left, that subject has been left to other disciplines, sociology or industrial relations. But as we see tonight, Peter is a leader in the analysis of a new and frankly somewhat disturbing view of working lives. We spend about a third of our adult time at work, and what goes on there is very important to our emotional health and well-being. And Peter, you've identified behaviors that can cause pain in others, even our friends, and perhaps more important, you've suggested techniques that we can all use to prevent pain from creating toxins. And you've challenged us to change our organizations to make them more humane and still productive and fulfilling. So for that, we thank you. This has been a very worthy chapter in the long and storied history of the Vancouver Institute. Thank you.